Welcome to Anaesthesia on Air, the official podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Ramesh Santhrapala, and I'm one of the Royal College of Anaesthetists Council members. I'm also a consultant anaesthetist at Guy's and St Thomas's in London. Today, I'm excited to share that we're being joined by two very esteemed guests for the theme of International Women's Day. We're joined by Dr. Kate Stannard and Dr. Helen Burdett from the WIMIN organization, which stands for Women in Medicine International Network. Women in Medicine International Network tries to fill the medical conference gap around the needs of women in medicine by bringing different specialties together and having meetings where ideas can be shared and learned in a relaxed and safe environment. Before we progress to knowing more about the network and also some of the challenges facing women in medicine, I wanted to hand over to our two guests to introduce themselves.
Oh, hi, I'm Dr. Kate Stannard. I'm a consultant anaesthetist at Maidstone and Tunbridge Wells NHS Trust. So that's a district general hospital in Kent. My special areas are anaesthetising adults and children for ENT surgery and doing a high-risk orthopaedic list. And I run a high-risk pre-assessment clinic as well. In my other roles, we have a new Kent Medical School, which I'm quite involved with year three and year five. And for the last 5 years, I've been a primary FRCA examiner at the college. And about 4 years ago, Helen and I set up Women. So that's me.
Hi, I'm Helen Burdett. I'm a consultant anaesthetist based at the same trust. I've got a special interest in paediatric anaesthesia, and we do a lot of tertiary level orthopaedic procedures in our DDH, which helps make the local population have a much better service and can be looked after locally rather than being transferred up to London. I also do a paediatric high risk assessment clinic. I am the clinical director for critical care and theatres at the Trust. And I am also a final FRCA examiner at the college and have been so since 2020.
It was fantastic to have you both join us. Thank you so much. I think for the benefit of our listeners, it'd be really good to know more about your network, Women in Medicine International Network. So can you speak to what the original goals or the aspirations were? And specifically, given the theme of the International Women's Day 2024 is inspiring inclusion, how do you see the network speak to that?
Okay, so the reason we started it in the first place was we got slightly fed up, for want of a better word, with conferences that we attended, and we found they didn't actually address any needs of women in medicine. And it was all very repeated, generic lectures that weren't actually adding anything to anaesthesia in our view, and also our lives. The other thing is that any conferences aimed at women weren't concentrating on the whole age group of women, and it's very much to do with less than full-time training and maternity leave. And after that, apparently there was nothing of any relevance to discuss, which we disagreed with. And the other thing was that, as you know, we've both been consultants. I've been slightly longer than Kate, being slightly longer in the tooth. We've been consultants for over 20 years, and we practice medicine in teams. So we don't really understand the relevance of having silo learning where you're not in discussion with anyone else. Because when in the real world, we're out there, you are discussing with your surgeons and your nursing staff and the whole team around you. So felt sensible for us to start to address that. And certainly I learn an awful lot from my GP colleagues in primary healthcare. And you understand why gastroenterologists are doing the investigations they're doing, and everyone's different areas of interest. And you actually learn something which you can then bring to the table and then bring a much more meaningful discussion when you're discussing patient care.
So we were really just trying to modernize conferences, to be honest, and make them modern and relevant, and also just to enhance everyone's experience, because we were finding we were going to these sort of conferences with, you know, windowless conference rooms, huge ones. You didn't really feel you had a voice. They were very dominated by middle-aged men talking about their pet topics. So we wanted to bring primary, secondary and tertiary care all together under one roof. Everyone has a voice. It's a very sort of level playing field. And just, you know, to be able to discuss some of the challenges facing not only women in medicine, but women as patients too.
Yeah, I think all those goals are really admirable. More so for interest, how did the two of you meet originally?
Well, we originally met at a wedding.
Like all good relationships.
So Kate trained up in this area and I trained down in the southwest of England, and for various reasons came up to Kent and said I'd give it a year because I thought Kent was built up and busy and southeast England would be awful. And here I am over 20 years later, still here. And then Kate was a trainee in the trust, and when she came, you came back as a locum consultant,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah.
And then we tag teamed having babies whilst Kate locumed, and then another one would have a baby and she would locum that one, and she had a baby, and it all, so it was all very perfect. It worked perfectly. And then applied for a job.
Mm.
So we've both been here many, many years.
Who would have known? So speaking to specifically diversity and empowerment in all aspects of society, which you've already spoken to, so, you know, not only medical professionals, but patients and wider kind of MDT teams, given the kind of theme around inspire inclusion this year for International Women's Day, what do you see the network doing around then, and what aspirations do you have around that topic?
Well, we have really broadened our profile of from our first meeting, we have since then broadened our sort of profile of topics. And we're discussing actually quite difficult issues, but I feel in quite an bizarrely in a kind of upbeat and productive way. So, for example, our last conference, we had Dr. Olamide Dada, who's an amazing young doctor who set up an organisation, and she started it from scratch, called Melanin Medics. So this was looking at Afro-Caribbean doctors in training and future medical students. And this has become, just in the last year, a vast organisation. So we sort of, she was able to explain some of what she's doing and educate us actually in challenges faced by that cohort of doctors and future doctors. We were very fortunate to have Professor Carrie Newlands, who was part of the working party into sexual misconduct, which was a working party under the auspices of the Royal College of Surgeons. So you'd have seen it all in the press about the high level of sexual misconduct aimed at female surgical trainees. So that went to press the week before our meeting, and Carrie was able to come and discuss it in a full and frank manner, which was quite an eye-opener. Well, I don't know how much it was an eye-opener for us, but it's a useful, very useful thing to have had it aired and acknowledged, because, you know, the naysayers at last have the sort of the data in front of them.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Just having that safe space to be able to open up these conversations. And it's really important. You've obviously touched on two very kind of sensitive areas around the challenges that we can face as women in medicine. In general, broadening out through your conferences and network, are there any themes that you see that are particularly pertinent to women right now in medicine?
In our next conference, we've got a whole section on women as patients, and we're looking at, with all the repeated maternity issues that keep rising up around the country. Last year, we had Bill Kirkup talking, who was excellent, telling us about his review, and the same themes keep coming up as to why units aren't working. And this next year, we're concentrating even more on that, in the health disparity for Afro-Caribbean ladies and Asian ladies, and their mortality rate in the UK is four times higher for Afro-Caribbeans than it is their Caucasian counterparts, which is shocking. So we do look at very difficult topics, but we've got such a network and a community within us that everyone can speak very, very freely, and we get right to the nub of issues in conferences that you normally just feel the surface is being scratched. And it's lovely that we have conferences where people can actually speak openly without fear of any reprisal or judgment. So we tackle a lot of difficult subjects, but also Kate's marvel on Instagram and contacting people and getting them to say yes to coming and talking. And you know, we're discussing Martha's Rule at our next conference as well, and the importance that patients can be heard, and female patients can be heard, because I think they're heard less than their male counterparts.
Yeah, so we have Mary P. Mills, who you'll be aware has just passed Martha's Rule through the courts. So she's coming to speak specifically about Martha and her experience and getting this legislation passed. And she will be speaking along with Henrietta Hughes, the patient safety officer for the UK. And just going back to the Black Maternal Health, we've got Sam Allen, who's head of NHS England Maternity Services, and Dame Leslie Regan speaking, along with Sandra Igwe, who set up the Motherhood Group, who's done a lot of the hard campaigning to get this issue of the differential care received by Black and Asian mothers on labour ward. And because the data has been collected by Embrace, we've known about this for 20 years, nothing really has changed or improved for these women. And I think if it wasn't for people like Sandra campaigning, it would still be off the radar. So we're absolutely delighted to have her along. And we have, out of our cohort of doctors that attend, we have quite a high number of obstetricians, gynecologists, and paediatricians, don't we?
Yes.
So, you know, I think it will be highly relevant to most of us in the lecture theatre.
Yeah, it's really challenging, isn't it? I mean, we saw it during the pandemic. It's obviously, you know, a topic that differential outcomes, you know, depending on ethnicity and race, is obviously something that's close to my heart. On a personal note, I come from a very close community, and there's multiple challenges. I think kind of broadening out to kind of the systemic challenges that women face in medicine, and you can draw on personal experience to the degree that you both feel comfortable to share. What are those challenges, and what ways have you found, either personally or through the network, ways of facing them and potentially overcoming them?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's really important to surround yourself with other strong women in medicine, because they are your tribe and they will have shared experiences with you, and they will sort of validate your behaviour. You know, we get all this language used, you know, language changes as we progress through medicine as women, doesn't it? And then when we get to sort of our later stages of our career, we become difficult, bossy, aggressive, you know, assertive. So I think it's quite important to realise that this kind of thing is not acceptable. I know it's sort of drip drip, and we sort of accept it, don't we? But actually, I think if you surround yourself with your own like, it gives you the confidence to face some of these things. And you know, if it's just from a pure workforce problem, we have a massive problem in medicine at the moment, because we're recruiting over 60%. Of medical students are women. But when you look at consultant level within hospitals, there's only four specialties that have more women than men. That's paediatrics, obs and gynae, rheumatology, and I think haematology. And there's a massive attrition rate in all the other specialties. So you just have to do the maths. You know, we've got a problem, haven't we? So we need to start keeping women within hospital medicine. And I think one important thing to do with that, as you mentioned, was mentoring, but also role modeling, and also giving these women a platform that they realize they can do it, and they can do it, and they can be supported by each other. What do you think?
I think personally, I thought one really interesting thing that happened when we first did our very first conference, we had a rule. It was a very small conference. There was only 24 of us. And the deal was that everybody had to give a lecture. And what I found amazing was these well-trained, experienced, intelligent women, and the number of women who came to me and said, I have nothing to talk about, was stunning. I mean, it was just utterly amazing. The fact that they honestly thought they'd been consultants for 10, 15 years and they had nothing to say. And what's been really lovely seeing is watching people blossom and totally come out and now enjoy giving lectures, realize they have got so much to offer and so much experience that they now are asking to give lectures, which I think is brilliant. And I just thought that was really eye-opening, that these women who, you know, we've all achieved in our jobs, we're all intelligent, we're running families at home, we're taxi services to our children, you know, it's non-stop. And yet at work, they felt that they had nothing more to offer from a personal, you know, giving back. Not giving back as such, but...
Contributing,
yeah. Thank you.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, there is just so much I can go into in that. But what do you think was the change from, you know, the start when perhaps there wasn't, I dare to say, confidence, actually, because like you said, these are all high-achieving, highly intelligent women. But what do you think was the internal narrative or the cultural change that had these women, you know, feeling empowered and feeling like they can speak and they've got something to say?
Because they were listened to. I think women are very good at listening. And I think that's what we felt was missing from a lot of the conferences that we were going to. You weren't heard, you weren't listened, you were looked over. And then I think women get into this pattern of self-silencing. You know, we've all been there, haven't we? Been to meetings, you know, they may be discussing, for example, the best way to anaesthetise patients for hip replacements, which I've been doing for 20 odd years, but nobody asks you. You know, it's often the men holding the forum and you just sit there and say nothing because you feel if you say anything, you're not listened to or you're talked over. So it becomes a habit, I think, and it does affect confidence. And I think at our conferences, the feedback we get a lot of really positive feedback from our speakers as well as our delegates. We had a barrister last year who said it was the best day she'd had for years.
Yeah, there was someone who said it was a brilliant quote. She's very much more eloquent than I am, and she said joyous and conference, these are two words that are generally not seen in the same sentence. And I think because as Kate says, everyone is listened to, and your view, who's there, is as valid as anyone else's. No one has a more valid view than anyone else or a more valid opinion. And people realise that and it comes across. So it's a really nurturing experience, and everyone comes away having discussed really difficult topics. Everyone comes away full of vigour and actually empowered, and their bucket is refilled. As someone said once at a conference, I feel my bucket is refilled now. And they come away with a very positive outlook. And
do you remember they said it's the chicken soup of conferences?
So it's, and we also spend time on looking after ourselves as people. So we have yoga sessions. And to me, you know, we take so little time in life to make time for ourselves. We're always as women, putting the families first. You know, the animals in the house get more attention, and you're constantly on a treadmill running. And you know, we're all plate spinning, and occasionally we drop a plate or two, whilst we're trying to juggle too much. And this conference is for the people who are attending, and it's their conference, and they get to listen, learn, discuss, contribute. And you listen to, and you know, we also spend time with downtime with all these people. So we just have just a really lovely atmosphere.
Yeah, that's really beautifully put, actually. So it's that sense of community and feeling heard. So you touched upon mentoring and role modeling. Now, as someone who's you know, earlier in their career than both of yourselves, I find mentoring and, you know, the role of role models fundamental. You know, Fiona Donald, our president, is a fantastic mentor and role model for women in anaesthesia, you know, someone who really emphasizes that nurturing quality of lift as you climb, you know, open up the doors behind you. Can you speak more to that around kind of mentoring and the role of role models?
Well, I mean, it's something that we're trying to focus on as women, as our organisation involves. I just talk about it from an organisational point of view. So we're trying to give opportunities to doctors in training behind us. So we have launched a research competition. It's very open. We try and do some generous shortlistings. We had some fantastic projects presented last year, and the winner of the poster presentation was this fantastic dynamic female ENT surgeons from Addenbrooke, who'd done been looking after deaf girls in Malawi by giving bone conduction headphones, and they won the prize money, and they donated the prize money to Malawi to provide more headphones, and Addenbrooke's matched the prize money. So it had quite a sort of big effect. And also, you know, it's good for them coming up through training. We make it very clear that anyone can contact us through the women email address. And we have had a few sort of upsetting emails from people, and we've been able to sort of reply and say, please come along to the meeting, we'll look forward to seeing you. And people have. And the feedback has been that they've found the speakers, you know, inspirational role models, and the information useful, and it has buoyed them up, and it's renewed their interest in medicine. That's quite common feedback that we get. We get very lengthy feedback. Ken sends a very concise feedback form, but we get add-ons of A4 pages of of comments, don't we?
They do. I think another thing there with the younger, if I'm allowed to say that nowadays, trainees coming through, what's good is that they feel very empowered to come and speak to us directly or message directly. And because we have got such a large network now, we will generally know a person in that area that we can put them in touch with. So at the last conference, one of the junior anaesthetists was having trouble with her trust with whatever issue it was, something doomed being related to be a female medic. So we were able to contact the trust concerned and talk to our contacts there, and then it all got sorted out for them. So I think it's just making everything accessible, and people don't know what where to look for help. So with our network, we've met lots of different people, and we use that network, and we just direct dial them and just go, can you sort this out? This is a real problem for this girl. This is really upsetting for her, and get things done, and just cut through all the red tape and all the paperwork and the tick boxing that goes on nowadays. So it's just going back to communication between people and trying to make that much easier.
Yes, I mean, other examples are that we had a doctor, and she was very disillusioned, but she wanted to stay within medicine, and she wanted to sort of think about a sort of career change within medicine. And again, we were able to put her in contact. She's thinking about going into menopausal women's health medicine, and we were able to put her in contact with quite prominent people in that field. And she was able to go and speak to them and get, you know, set about changing direction of her career rather than losing medicine completely, which I think she was pretty close to doing, which would have been obviously a huge shame.
So years ago we were both college tutors, and what was interesting then was some of the female juniors coming through who felt they weren't able to have that career that they wanted because of family life and other pressures on them. And it's been really, really lovely seeing trainees who were going to give up, and talking to them and just saying, look, it is possible. You actually can have it all. You can't have it all at the same time, but you can have everything you want in life, and don't let anyone tell you that you can't. And we've retained lots of young female anaesthetists who are fantastic, you know, really good. And they've stayed in anaesthesia and have continued their training. And I think really because they were told very plainly that you can do this. It is totally possible. And just because you are maybe a single mum or you've got three children and there's lots of pressures on you, or you're finding, you know, the practicalities of revising for exams, and just giving them help and advice about what to do, and saying you know if you really enjoy doing anaesthetics, then don't compromise to do another specialty that you think will be easier, because at the end of the day you're going to be doing this for many, many years, so you need to enjoy what you're doing. You know, I still enjoy my job, which is great. You know, when those theatre doors close and I get on with anaesthetising someone, I find it really enjoyable.
However, we do still have an attrition rate in anaesthesia. So it falls off to about 33% of anaesthetic consultants are women. So, you know, there is room for improvement. And I think at our last conference, we had a very inspirational economist called Aviva Wittenberg-Cox, and she writes for Forbes, and she's written stuff for Harvard Business School and things. And she's done a lot of work on looking at the trajectory of a woman's career and how it differs from a man's, i.e. a man's is a linear trajectory, and a woman's actually isn't linear. It plateaus off at various points, depending on where she is in her life and, you know, other outside career milestones. So, for example, having children, you hit a sort of period that I call the trenches, where you are just fighting fire and you have to be easy on yourself. You're not going to, you know, don't put yourself under pressure to achieve all the extra roles within your department. You just need to manage yourself and give yourself enough space so you don't get completely exhausted, and then you will re-emerge from that phase. And that's when having some women behind you to support you, because the men have you know, happily careered off into the distance, so you can sometimes feel quite left behind, but that is surmountable.
Again, a lot there. So I think there's real power in the network, if you, as you've emphasized a few times, but also that psychological safety of, you know, being heard and actually being able to kind of action on, you know, that, in the sense of being able to be connected with the right individuals to either, you know, empower change individually or on a much greater level. So forgive me, I can't remember the year that the network started, but since that time, what changes have you seen? We've already spoken to the kind of generational changes that you might see coming through, but what do you see as kind of, you know, positive aspects? So things that have changed in the culture towards women, and potentially changes with relation to kind of, you know, the generations coming through as well.
I think the network, when we originally set it up, which was 2019, it was viewed as a bit of a joke by some men.
As a huge joke.
And what's really interesting is they now take it really seriously, and they would like to come to the conferences. People look at what we're talking about, and those men who had thought rather less of what we were doing, or just didn't take it seriously, and now seeing it very, very differently, and are asking to come. So, which they can come, absolutely. And as Kate mentioned, Aviva recently, she said something very, very, very valuable and very insightful, was that a lot of what we're talking about, we're already talking to the converted. And actually, we need to be talking to the unconverted, because they need to listen to what's being said, and we need to take everyone along with us, which was, she's a very an amazing speaker, I must say. And that was, which was, I would wholeheartedly agree with. And it's like when, you know, there's a big thing everyone going on about the menopause at the moment. And actually, those menopause lectures should be for the men. They should be attending these talks. It shouldn't just be for women to attend these things. You know, we are their colleagues. They are our colleagues.
I think another big change that we're seeing now is that, and this is something that Helen and I have been very focused on, actually, is that women are beginning to take up more space. You know, that's what we need. We need more women to take up space, such as yourself, up at the college, in what I call medico-political roles, as Helen is as CD. And I think by pulling women together at our conferences, I think that really helps everyone go back to their own trusts with facts and figures, with, you know, being empowered is an overused word, but they do go back empowered and they have the confidence to start taking up more space. And then, we, you know, we will see change.
I think flowing on from that, what do you think are the responsibilities of women in leadership roles, in supporting other women? Are there any things that you would like to see changed? Are there any changes that you've seen for the good or otherwise?
I think that the women as leaders need to be letting the ladders down for the other women to climb up behind them. I think there's been in the past quite a lot of women getting up there and then closing the trap door behind them and not actually encouraging others to come up. I think we're very lucky where we work and that those doors are open and those ladders are being let down. And I think that is one of the main responsibility of women leaders, is to make sure that they're pointing at people saying, you can come up here too. Come on, let's get going. Come and join it and come and join, because, you know, they've got so much to offer.
And I think if you look at other professional areas, so look at business, for example, you get, you know, the right people get headhunted. You know, they get asked to apply for these positions. They're not necessarily taking the people who do apply in the first place. They're not necessarily the right people for these posts. So I think medicine needs to take a good, long, hard look at itself and start trying to find the right people for the jobs, rather than just purely accepting the people that apply, because 9 times out of 10, they will be men. And the women won't necessarily have the confidence. They certainly have the ability. So I think we should be a bit more proactive in filling very visible roles with the right people. I'm not saying women necessarily, but I'm saying the right people for these jobs. The ones that don't bring their ego before themselves when they go through the door, but actually who are concerned about making change for the better.
So I'll paraphrase, it's letting the ladder down. It's something that I call lift as you climb. And I think, you know, it's something that I feel very passionate about as well. I think it's fundamental, but also leveling that equity. So, you know, proactively identifying those who have the relevant experience, expertise, the relevant skills, ability to lead from a place of compassion and empathy.
Emotional intelligence.
Yeah, emotional intelligence. So Kate and Helen, you've not only set up this incredible network, but I understand that it has a charitable arm.
Yes, I mean, we were quite aware, I suppose, that through accident to birth, we're actually highly fortunate, aren't we? We're born in the in you know we work in a place where we have lots and lots of opportunities as women, so we didn't want it to be all poor us, because you know it's quite the reverse. So we wanted to look at to see if we could help women and girls who are far less fortunate. So we, I won't bore you with the details, but we happened upon a fantastic charity in Ghana that focuses on empowering girls and women in some of the most marginalised communities in northern Ghana on the border with Burkina Faso. And it's run by a woman, Dorcas Apore. So there's no sort of middleman. Well, there's no men at all, but there's no, the money goes direct to source. So with the small amount of monies we do raise from the conferences, we've been able to, just simple things really, we've been able to provide, I think it's now probably about six high schools in northern Ghana with the girls with reusable sanitary protection, because that was stopping them from staying in period poverty, was stopping them from staying in further education. So they can now, it's a very simple thing for us. We get it, then we get a spreadsheet back from the charity and we can see where every last penny has gone. So we literally don't waste a penny. So that's been, and we get feedback from the charity. So that's been quite a sort of uplifting and worthwhile focus.
Absolutely. And the mothers are taught how to weave baskets and make a living. So they're not dependent on anyone else. So they're being, so it's all, you know, very sustainable. So they cut their grass and they weave their baskets and sell them for a decent price, the price they should be paid, not peanuts. So they can support their family themselves and not be reliant on anyone else. So it's pointless going into places and just giving someone some money. Actually, you need to provide them with the ability to be able to provide for themselves.
Yes, and we've worked quite collaboratively with Deb Brown, who's an American woman who's a lecturer at Cambridge University, who arranges with Dorcas to import the baskets over to the UK. And so we've been able to, through with Deb, we've managed to sell quite a few of those. And we've arranged contracts for some of the women in Ghana with UK-based companies and some over in the States, so that they can keep exporting their baskets and get a decent amount, decent salary from their work.
Have you had the chance to meet some of the women that you're impacting in Ghana, or even make a trip out there?
We haven't yet. Well, we've met Dorcas, because Dorcas is over with on a fully funded master's at Edinburgh University into aid and development. She's been fully funded by MasterCard. So Dorcas was able to come to the last conference and tell us all about it. I've had video calls with the women in the villages, literally while they're producing their baskets, which has been really lovely. And yeah, no, we will have a trip out there before too long. But yeah, we've just been intent on just being able to deliver some, you know, aid and also to help them with their business.
Thanks for sharing that. We're coming to the near close of our podcast, and what I'd be really interested to know is, where would you like to take the network next?
Well, we've got a huge board helping our network. Kate's social media, and I'm the spreadsheet person. So basically, it's two of us. And we, you know, we do this in our so-called spare time. So we would certainly like to make it bigger, broader, and more. But the practicalities of, and all the you know, the financial worries on us. So we have to put all the money up for these conferences, which are not cheap to run. And then we also try and make it affordable as possible. So we're not trying to make profits at all. In fact, we're not profit. But, you know, there is only us two doing it. So Kate will have huge plans for where we're going.
Yes, I always have the grand plans. And Helen, as the banker, is the brakes. That's how it works, isn't it?
Yes.
But our next meeting is at Cambridge University, and we've got some amazing, amazing speakers. So each time we have a conference, something more evolves from it. So it's quite organic, actually, in the way the whole thing is developed. We have student representatives now. We'll get some doctor in training representatives. I have approached the Royal Society of Medicine about having a sort of one day jamboree for doctors in training, just address, specifically addressing their things, you know, a bit like, you know, careers market, just talking to women in these careers, and just lots of useful advice. But so that's a sort of work in progress.
So incredible amount of work by essentially two people, which is phenomenal, really. I think to close the podcast, so we generally ask for top tips, and I'm going to slightly reframe it. So if you were going to advise the Kate and Helen 20 years ago when you two first met about a career in medicine, what would be individually your three top tips?
I would say always go for the job you want. Don't be told that you're unlikely to get it because the competition will be high. And look at that end game and look at those people in. I chose anaesthesia. I was a paediatrician before, and it was the anaesthetist that I gelled with, and it was their approach to work that I gelled with. And that's why I made the move. But on that way, knowing that where I wanted to end up, I made sure that I had the right qualifications and the right experience. So I chose the jobs that I knew would help me get the next job that I wanted, so that I and only ever applied for jobs that I actually wanted to take. And I never did that. Or apply for this one, no one applies for it, you'll get it.
Yeah, well, that's good advice. I mean, I would say keep a really open mind, because I think we can get quite tunnel visioned in medicine. You know, it's all about getting the next job, getting your exams, which obviously highly important, but that's going to be for a short, concentrated amount of time. But then really keep an open mind. You know, if you had told me then that I, you know, Helen and I'd be running a network for women in medicine, I would never have believed it, but here we are and we've done it, and it's, you know, it's going really well. So just keep, you know, be open to opportunities, say yes to things that you think maybe might be out of your reach, but you'll find they probably aren't.
That's fantastic. Well, I think we could have this conversation go on and on, but we're regressively going to have to bring it to a close. So thank you so much, Kate and Helen, for joining us today. We'll post links to the upcoming conference alongside this podcast. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.